Did you know there's an online cannabis company that ships federally legal THC right to your door? And they found a way to combine THC with carefully selected functional ingredients to create gummies, baked goods, and flower for whatever type of buzz you'd want. I'm talking about Mood.com. They have an incredible line of cannabis gummies, and you get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code SPECIALISTS with an S on the end. This isn't some rinky-dink discount of 5 or 10%. This is 20% off your first order. Forget one-size-fits-all supplements that only get you high. Mood's functional gummies are optimized to kick in as little as 15 minutes and take you to the mood you're looking for. My favorite are the Sleepy Time Advanced gummies. That's right, those are for sleepy time. You know when you just can't fall asleep? Take these and they'll put you right in the mood. Beyond gummies, Mood also has a selection of flower, pre-rolls, bakery treats, and beverages. Listen, you can find gummies to just get you high pretty much everywhere these days. But Mood's functional gummies combine premium, federally legal THC with targeted botanicals to help you get into the perfect mood, usually in as little as 15 minutes. And everything ships discreetly right to your door. No dispensary lines, no awkward conversations, just better days and nights delivered to your doorstep. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with promo code SPECIALISTS with an S on the end. So head to Mood.com, find the functional gummy that matches exactly what you're looking for, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. And don't forget to use promo code SPECIALISTS when you check out to save 20% on your first order. Try it today at mood.com.
If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door. No insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
Movie buff specialist Phil and John are back as we continue counting down our top 100 movies of all time, and we are on to our 56th best movies ever, 45th episode of the season. John, we are almost actually at our 1-year anniversary. I think that comes up in about a month here, which is crazy because we took 2 or 3 weeks off here. So that's why we're not getting a full 52 in, and it's going to be around like 48, 49. Tonight, though, we're talking about two of Hollywood's most classic movies probably ever. And I don't say that lightly. We have Sunset Boulevard from 1950, the classic Billy Wilder, one of the greatest screenplays ever written, just endlessly quotable. And we have Goldfinger, the first, in my estimation, quintessential Bond. It's not my favorite of the Sean Connery Bonds. I actually think the one right before it, From Russia with Love, is the best one, in my opinion. But the fact that this is what Bond is always supposed to feel like, is Goldfinger. Mm-hmm. And I think this was the first one where it was like, okay, now they know what they're doing. They know how to lean into it. It's got so many over the top moments, but it doesn't feel corny. They do a good job of balancing that. So these are two movies that I think are like iconic Hollywood. If you were to say to somebody, give me two classic Hollywood movies that kind of define the 50s and 60s, these would be two movies you'd probably point to on your list. And John, because you never disappoint, I believe this was your first time watching Sunset Boulevard.
It certainly was. It's been on my list for a while. And I'm really glad I watched it now at the tail end of this year, where we've just been diving into so much different cinema, because it really helped me understand the film more and how to react to it a lot more than I think I would have if I had even watched it before we started this project.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing with Sunset Boulevard. I always wonder, I've only ever watched this movie with movie fans. I watched this, well, I take that back. I watched this in film school once, and the people I talked to about it were movie fans. I always wonder how not big movie fans respond to a movie like Sunset Boulevard. Because Sunset Boulevard is very much a tongue-in-cheek movie about Hollywood and aging and becoming irrelevant and all of that fun stuff that gets lumped in. This isn't like Singing in the Rain, where at the end of the day, you could still be like, hey, I just want to watch Gene Kelly dance around, even though that movie's essentially about the same thing that this movie's about, mm-hmm. which is how do you deal with the introduction of talkies? But this movie has so many references to film stuff. And I think that's just where Billy Wilder's love for film really, really comes out. This movie ages like a fine wine. It's 71 years old, which blows my mind. It makes me so sad. But it's this, we still see these exact same things happening to people in real life who live in Hollywood. I mean, we see this all the time, all the aging actresses and actors who are no longer in touch. And I mean, Mickey Rourke is the king of plastic surgery. And, you know, it's like you start to look at this and then they start playing roles that are kind of fitting in what they are. Gloria Swanson was one of the biggest silent stars ever. And then she plays Norma Desmond in this movie. It's just brilliant casting. It's a brilliant movie, brilliant screenplay. And I just think it's so much fun. But John, I'm interested to hear what you think. Clearly, we're starting with Sunset Boulevard because the other movie has a little guy named James Bond that people have probably heard about. So,
yeah, it was a movie that I wasn't quite 100% sure how to go into. Obviously, we've been watching a lot of noir films the last little while, and it's so nice that this is kind of framed as a noir, but isn't a noir at the same time. Mm-hmm. I really think it's a great play and a really great decision by Billy Wilder on how to structure the film to make it more impactful. Because you go in, you're starting off with a very typical noir start. You have the voiceover and mm-hmm. you see the dead body, you know there's a crime coming, and we jump back, but we're not dealing with some PI who's on the case or anything like that. We're dealing with the subject, like the dead body himself and his mm-hmm. story as to how he got there. And that framing just engages you so well as soon as you start the film.
Yeah, I think what I like about this movie, and I know there's others that came before this, but this really was one of the first, and noir people are going to shoot me over this because there's probably something I'm missing, but this was one of the first noirs that wasn't about a cop or a PI or something like that. That was really mainstream. Like, this caught people's attention. And this is what we see throughout history now. We saw it when we talked about Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, Shane Black. Like, we see the influence of a movie like this where it's kind of your ordinary down-on-his-luck guy who's just desperate for something to happen and they accidentally stumble into something. This movie has kind of a horror movie feel to it at the beginning, which is something that goes unnoticed a lot of the time. But the comparisons to Dracula or Frankenstein or something like that, pulling up to this mansion, which is essentially a castle, and he's about to walk in, and even the way Norma Desmond is introduced is very similar to Bela Lugosi in Dracula movie. Mm-hmm. You know, we see this all the time in horror, but this is not a horror, but it still has that old Hollywood feel, like you're walking onto Tower of Terror at Disney World, and something bad is going to happen to you. So the way it's framed is more in that sense, you know, because if you think about the original Dracula movies, they are about a person keeping a diary as he goes into Dracula and like just goes into Transylvania and goes into Count Dracula's home. And that's what we're seeing here. So it's got horror elements, but it's also a film noir that's not really a film noir because it's this writer. It's not somebody who's actually trying to discover something, solve a mystery. He doesn't care about any of that. He just wants it because he's trying to get his rebound and get back out there, just like Norma Desmond is. The parallels are very much there, except she's pathetic, and he's just somebody that you're not really proud to be associated with.
Yeah, and that's where Sunset Boulevard really excels as this critique of Hollywood and this criticism of Hollywood, because it does introduce all of these different tropes. The fact that we are kind of getting this harken back to Universal monster movies with the setup for the entire film, especially when you consider the fact that this entire film is about someone's descent into madness.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't really realize it until you get to the end because of how far she's already descended into madness by the time we meet her.
And this is one of those rare movies where the character hanging around, despite being very aware that their counterpart is a psychopath, works. A lot of times we see this in newer movies where it's a young person hanging around with a young person and they're trying to force the love interest. And it's like, okay, this person's going to kill you. What are you doing? But in this one, because it's so clear that he couldn't get a job, he can't even get it writing additional dialogue. He can't get anything, but that's all he knows how to do. He owes money to people. His car's got double flat. Like, what is he going to do? There's nothing he can do about anything. And so it makes sense that he would hang around with this woman who he thinks he still has the power over, because at the end of the day, he can just walk out of the mansion and she can't, and she'll pay for things. And it's this leech type, even though she is leeching off of him, he is just as much leeching off of her. It's this, you know, it's this really, really bad relationship, but it makes sense why William Holden's character doesn't just sprint out of there at the first sign of danger. And every time he does leave, he ends up coming back. Does he come back at the one scene when she commits or attempts to commit suicide because he cares about her? No, he's coming back because he cares about his future and he sees her as his only way to get there.
Yeah, and the film doesn't shy away from that fact either. The fact that we have that the interaction between Joe and
Norma. Max?
No, the writer. The other one.
Oh, yeah, I can't ever think of her name.
Yeah.
Her.
But the interaction that the two of them have, when he's like, why would I go away from this?
Mm-hmm.
Why would I run away? With all of my 15 suits and all of this. Mm-hmm. And he's just talking about the cash cow that he's stumbled upon, where, yeah, is it a weird relationship he has with Norma? Absolutely. Because it's unhealthy. It's symbiotic, but both of them are the parasite and they're both slowly killing each other. But he's also benefiting from it because he's not living in a shitty apartment he can't afford anymore. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have people hounding him to repo his car anymore. He can afford living because of this situation he stumbled upon.
And he's getting material, because at the end of the day, he's looking at her as somebody who's just going to be great for any story. And that's why he's telling us the story that he would have written. He's telling us that. And it's one of the greatest movies Hollywood's ever seen. So he's telling us this story about Norma Desmond and everything. And, you know, all the people she keeps around, which I love that scene where they're playing bridge and it's got all the actual actors from the silent era. Buster Keaton, all he says in the entire movie is pass, because he never made it into the talkies. He was a silent movie actor and that was it. He just passed on everything. Once it was, now you have to do like talking. That wasn't for him. Chaplin made that adjustment. Keaton didn't. And I love like this whole like Walking Dead type thing, because they're so stuck in that time and talking about how like they didn't have to pay taxes on those giant mansions when they were being built and all, like all of these things you don't even think about now. But that's what's really setting the scene. And this movie's made in 1950, so it's very much set in 1950, which to us seems like a very long time ago now. And it's talking about an era that was only 20-something years old at that point. So it makes sense why Cecil B. DeMille is still struggling to just tell her to get out, because he feels bad, and she did make him just as much as he made her, and so nobody really has the gall to tell her no.
Yeah, I mean, it comes to the fact where, like, Max is still hanging around despite being her first husband.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And, like, nobody wants to tell Norman no, because it's, they all kind of acknowledge the fact that it's better if Norma gets to stay inside this little time bubble she's created for herself, mm-hmm. where she's isolated from the world and doesn't have to acknowledge the passage of time.
Yeah, and it's almost like they know that she'd be humiliated, so they're protecting her. But at the same time, while protecting her, they're also creating the problem. Like, they're doing both. They're making her life better, but also making it worse, because she just sits there and watch silent movies with herself as the star of every one of them. And Max keeps writing her the fan mail to keep up the charade, because she is suicidal. And they know that if they stop the charade, something bad is going to happen. When Cecil B. DeMille lets her come in and sit down in the director's chair, it's all the extras who are coming up to her. Mm-hmm. It's not the actual actors in the movie. It's the extras, because they're all just taking the work because they need the work. And she's such an idol to them, but they can't get work either. They're only good at being extras because extras don't talk most of the time. And they're in the background, but she can't be in the background. I mean, this movie has two of the greatest lines of all time with Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up. And I am big. It's the pictures that got small. And I think that mentality is so indicative of Hollywood just in general. Every time a new movie, it's never as good as what it was in the 70s. But the movies in the 70s at the time weren't considered as good as the movies from the 40s. And in 20 years, it's not going to be as good as the movies from the 90s. It's just always looking back and just not thinking that what's happening now could possibly be as good as what came before it. And Norma is so stuck in this. She can't get out of it. And she still thinks she's big, because in her own mind, she is. And to a lot of people, she is. She's not. It's not that she's not big. She's just irrelevant now. Mm-hmm. But, you know, aging stars, I mean, they become irrelevant maybe with new movies, but people are still going to talk about Robert De Niro all the time. But are we always going to sit here and say, well, it's not as good as that one because that had Robert De Niro and Al Pacino. No actors are as good as that. When I sit down and I say that I think Ryan Gosling in Blue Valentine gives the greatest performance in film history, people laugh at me because it's Ryan Gosling and it's only 11 years old. Why is that any different than saying back in 1967, Dustin Hoffman gave the greatest performance of all time when he was younger than Ryan Gosling was in this? It's just, it's this whole aging thing and just not believing that what's happening now is nearly worth what was, because all you can hold on to as you get older is what you did that was successful.
Yeah, and it's one of those things that we don't like acknowledging as human beings. We don't like acknowledging aging. We don't like acknowledging the fact that the world is kind of moving beyond us and that we've kind of lost our place in the world. We don't like feeling that. We like feeling important, because in our eyes, we are the most important person in the world.
Yeah.
And when you're living a life like Norma was, in which she was this massive star where all the attention's on her, to go from that to nothing, it would be devastating for any of us to feel that. Think about how we feel as we age, as not these people with all this attention.
Yeah.
And then think about how much that is amplified when you're under the microscope like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's why we see it so often with the plastic, you know, all the things that, like, you know, us regular folk make fun of, the plastic surgery and, you know, always going for the next hottest wife or the next hottest husband, whatever you can find, all of these things that are just so superficial. But at the same time, until you live out there and are actually around it all the time, you don't actually realize how important all of those things are. Having the nice car, having the hot girlfriend, having the hot boyfriend, all of those things are so valued there because it's such a superficial city. And so once you start to lose that, all of a sudden you're not exciting anymore. And if you're not exciting, you can't make it in Hollywood. That's the truth. You have to be exciting. And not for nothing, at the end of this movie, Norma Desmond finally does become exciting again. And that's why there's hundreds of people in her house. So yeah, she might not be getting in a movie. She's going to go to jail for murdering somebody, but she is finally big again. And she's exciting again. And therefore people care that she is you know, that she, they don't even care that she murdered somebody. It's all about getting her. Why did she do it? They don't even care that William Holden's laying there dead in the water at that point.
Well, and that's the fascinating thing about the ending of this film, which is haunting. It's absolutely haunting and disturbing, however you want to describe it. But Norma's response isn't a response of shock from having murdered Joe. Mm-hmm. Norma's response is a complete disassociative state based on the fact that she's finally getting attention again.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Like, and that's that again, it plays into that whole idea of like this descent into madness that we're watching in this film, because she's just getting to a point where all that matters is that people are thinking about her again.
Yep.
And it grieves her power. And yep. Nothing. I don't think I've ever seen anything more chilling than the delivery of,
yeah,
I'm ready for my close-up, Mr. DeVille.
No, that last scene, all these years later, is still one of the most disturbing scenes ever to me, because it's a real person. You know, yeah. Like I, you know, in horror movies, like if you go watch Psycho, Anthony Perkins has millions of moments in that movie that you could say are the most disturbing moment ever. But there's something that's just so authentic about this. And since you know she's crazy the whole time, but there's still some redeeming qualities about her, and you understand that it's about loneliness and longing for people and all of that. And the fact that she loses it so bad that she thinks she's actually becoming a star again, and DeMille is just playing along with it. And what brilliance by Billy Wilder to, from the time, literally take one of the most famous, I would say probably at that time, the most famous director in the history of film,
mm-hmm.
and have him come in and be the person. And especially since a lot of what DeMille did and his rise to fame was during the silent era. You know, the original Ben-Hur was silent. People don't really realize a lot of that, but DeMille's rise, and for him to be the one doing it, like, it's just so, it's so well told. And, you know, that'll get me on another tangent with Billy Wilder. So I'll let you go, and then I'll start going off about Billy. So, you know.
Yeah, it also helps ground the film, because it simultaneously has this like ethereal feel to it. Once we get to the mansion, it's again, like harkening back on that Universal era where you get to the mansion, it's big, it's enormous. The scale of this house is ridiculous. And because of that, it almost doesn't feel real. It feels kind of dreamlike, which is, again, a trait we've talked about in other noirs we've discussed. It's something like fairy tale-esque.
Mm-hmm.
And like these were the films that were driving Hollywood at the time.
Yeah.
Like this is how these were all of these film genres that we're mentioning were so big at the time and were such a huge focus on at the time. The only one we really don't get in Sunset Boulevard is the musical craze that kind of helped with that transition to the talkies. And I think that's a good thing, because it does just highlight Hollywood in such a beautiful way.
Yeah, and there's no way you could fit the musical in here. You know what I mean? Like, no. Like that would have felt forced, whereas none of the other genres that he's using here feel forced. And I think that's what's so, you know, I think that's just what's so important about it is everything just feels natural in this movie, but he's still winking at you and using every genre at his disposal and all of the tropes of these other genres to tell his story. That's such a hard thing to pull off, and only somebody with the immense talent of Billy Wilder could pull it off. And that's going to get me going on a tangent here about Billy Wilder. So, you know, if you don't like Billy Wilder, now would be a good time to tune out. He really is the greatest writer in the history of film. And I don't care what country, anything like that. I think Billy Wilder is the greatest writer in the history of film, because Billy Wilder's movies are all writing. He never made a movie like Tarkovsky or Stanley Kubrick. He didn't rely on special effects in any of his movies. None of them. There's not one movie that you go down his list. It is all dialogue. It is all character. It is just driving forces. And his famous line was always, grab him by the throat and never let go. And you think about the movies he made, the movies he wrote, Sunset Boulevard, The Apartment, Some Like It Hot, Double Indemnity, Ace in the Hole, Witness for the Prosecution, The Lost Weekend, Sabrina, The 7-Year Itch, Stalag 17, The Fortune Cookie. It's insane to think that all of those movies came from one man. Because they're all icon. Every movie I just named, it won somebody an Oscar or got them nominated or is in some sort of top 100 list or whatever it is. And it just showed how well he grasped what made film film. And that's why he was the perfect person for Sunset Boulevard, because this story has been told numerous times. But nobody could tell it and set it in Hollywood and make it about an aging actress and a failing writer and a young, perky upstart writer and all of the other characters you see through Hollywood other than Billy Wilder. And he knocks it absolutely out. This, him doing this movie is like Paul Thomas Anderson doing Boogie Nights. Anybody else doing a porn movie about the San Fernando Valley would look like a joke. But Paul Thomas Anderson lived there during the rise of that. And he saw it and he was around it. And that's what Billy Wilder was doing here. You can't even, like, I always laugh when Sunset Boulevard was neither his first big hit or his last big hit or his masterpiece or his, like, universally regarded masterpiece, because there's so many others that came before it and after it and could also be considered by numerous people to be just as good, if not better, than this one. That's just an unbelievable, it's an unbelievable resume.
Yeah, it's an incredible feat for anyone to accomplish at any time. But to be doing this during this golden age of Hollywood where it was just this transitionary period. We'd moved away from silent films 20 years earlier. And to have an investigation into the meta experience of people living in Hollywood that also just presents itself as a good film. It's an incredible accomplishment to make when you didn't have people like us discussing and breaking down films all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And it really was like the Hollywood types were the ones who kept the Hollywood illusion alive. They were the ones who kept that going. And it was like Billy Wilder could see through it. Billy Wilder is very much like Charlie Kaufman nowadays, even though Charlie Kaufman really hasn't done much lately. But Charlie Kaufman could see through it all with a movie like Adaptation, Being John Malkovich, these movies that were about the process, about going through it, and about the struggles and the desperation of these people to remain relevant. Because while we pity Norma Desmond, and while we watch this movie and think she's so awful, Joe or whatever his name is going through the exact same thing of trying so hard to remain relevant, but we don't view him as pathetic because he's still young. If he's 10 years older, we're laughing at him too. But we still feel, he's got his future ahead of him. Whereas Norma Desmond, we sit there and say, why can't she just hang it up? Why can't she just get over it? It's so interesting of a dynamic. And it's funny how, you know, the perception will be different depending on where you are in your life and what age you are, even though you're both doing the exact same things.
I think the situation is also really important in understanding like our different audience responses to Joe versus Norman or Norma, because we also are immediately set up that Joe is strapped for cash and is not just looking for fame and accolade. He's looking for his meal ticket. And that's so important. Yeah. And it's so important for the audience to clutch onto that character that way. Because that is life, where so many people struggle to make ends meet. And when you show a character like that, it's just so relatable to the general masses that it kind of breaks the barrier that film sometimes has. If you kind of like look back to like theater and how like Shakespeare is directed at the regular people in the audience rather than like the nobility and the people who, you know, could afford the not covered in dirt seats.
Yeah.
Because, and like, that's how it became eternal. And it's the exact same thing Sunset Boulevard is doing by giving you a protagonist that the everyman can connect with.
Yeah.
If this film is shown from Norma Desmond's perspective, it's nowhere near as good, because you have to have that outside perspective of this person in addition to this protagonist who the audience relates to and can actually view the film through.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is a great I mean, normally writers are good people a lot of times, even though it becomes a tire trope sometimes. And I do think that in the 2000s, we start by having IMDb and Letterboxd and sites like this that are great for film discovery. We also started to create a genre of film that sucked, or we stopped having a genre of film that was really great, which a lot of people started to adopt the voiceover is lazy. Just because it was said an adaptation, everybody adopts that. Scorsese literally made his career on that. And you're not going to sit down and not like a Scorsese movie because he has voiceover in it. And so we see that. And so like all of these discussion boards and things like that have made it so that people are trying so hard to be different, to be unique, mm-hmm. to rather than just telling the best story, because they're trying to be the next groundbreaking thing. And so like, when you watch like the everyday man, which is, you know, William Holden's character in this movie, we hear it from his point of view as a writer. Nowadays, a lot of times, if the writer is the one who's telling the story, if they're doing voiceover, we're sitting there going, oh God, this is just the writer preaching to us. This is the writer of the movie preaching. That's sometimes true. There's this movie Cashback, which I watched in college. It's very much like this guy was struggling to make money, so he decided to write about this exact thing. That doesn't mean it's always true. And it's always that fine line between art and shit, right? Mm-hmm. And so with like a movie like Sunset Boulevard, if you can write dialogue the way Billy Wilder could, put as much voiceover and make it about a writer if you want. Because a lot of times writers are relatable. That's why writers are the ones who write movies. And that's why we go see them, because we're relating to them. The movie industry, the TV industry would all die if we stopped relating to it. Writers know how to relate to people. If you can write a good writer character, they're going to relate. And Billy Wilder was the best one at it.
Yep, absolutely.
So that's what I got. I just want to say, if anybody hasn't seen Ace in the Hole, it's his like, I would say it's his underappreciated gem. Because it doesn't end up on list and best pictures, all that stuff like The Lost Weekend, Double Indemnity, Some Like It Hot, The Apartment, Sunset Boulevard. Check out Ace in the Hole. It is, so let me just see what year it was made. It was directed in 1951. So actually the year after Sunset Boulevard. And for those who aren't familiar with it, it is a here's the synopsis on Letterboxd. A frustrated former big city journalist, now stuck working for an Albuquerque newspaper, exploits a story about a man trapped in a cave to revitalize his career, but the situation quickly escalates into an out of control media circus. It is unbelievable, and it could be about anything happening today. And in a world where our media in any country just runs rampant to give us whatever information they want to throw at us, that movie, 70 years old this year, it's mind-blowing. It is absolutely mind-blowing. Kirk Douglas in that movie is one of the most despicable characters ever, ever. And it's so damn entertaining. So check that one out. He knew what he was doing. But you have anything else you want to say about Sunset Boulevard other than the fact that Gloria Swanson did not win the Oscar for this movie? So that's a giant middle finger to everybody, especially since this came out the same year as All About Eve. And I would argue All About Eve and Sunset Boulevard are two of the most popular and best movies about Hollywood and about that era of Hollywood and all that. And All About Eve, which had Bette Davis and oh, my God, I'm totally drawing a blank. But anyway, that movie is Bette Davis and Ann Baxter. None of them won Best Actress either. So I just want to throw that out there. It was like Judy Holliday or Billie somebody like that. I think it was Judy Holliday for Born Yesterday. Yeah, okay. We're all talking about that one still 70 years later. So good job, Oscars. Way to nail that one. Sunset Boulevard lost to All About Eve, which I disagree with, but you can't really argue it because All About Eve is absolutely ridiculous too. And John, I'm going to assume you haven't seen All About Eve.
I haven't.
Come on, John. You got
to. I'm working on it.
John's so busy watching world cinema, he forgot to watch Hollywood movies.
That did happen.
It did. Well, George Sanders in that movie. Damn. Great movie. Check out All About Eve, John. That's your homework. When you come back to me next week, you better have seen it. But anyway, what was the best thing you watched this week?
Ooh, this week was an interesting one. I rewatched West Side Story, but I've already talked about that one as one of the best things I've seen. So, and I mean, I rewatched the original West Side Story. I haven't seen the Spielberg version yet.
Nobody has. It made $10 million. Anyway, continue.
Yeah. Didn't believe that when I read that.
Woof.
Holy cow. Woof. That is bad.
Yeah.
I rewatched the first five Spider-Man movies this weekend in a 24-hour span. Ooh, that was a long 24 hours. But the Sam Raimi Spider-Man movies are so much more fun than any of these modern movies, like modern superhero movies.
Mm-hmm.
They were just a different breed. They felt so much better, but by no means the best movies I watched this week. It comes down to two. I watched Harold and Maude for the first time.
Mm.
Very fun movie, despite the fact that it's like completely centered around death the entire movie. But the one I'm actually going to give it to, I rewatched 1999's Galaxy Quest this week.
Nice.
And that Galaxy Quest is underrated. So much better than I remember it being.
Yeah.
It was approached in the perfect way where it wasn't approached as like a parody of Star Trek. It was just approached as a Star Trek episode with the way that it's as if the cast of Star Trek was on Star Trek. And yeah. It's so well done. The cast is phenomenal. Like Tim Allen gives a great performance. Alan Rickman's absolutely phenomenal, as is Sigourney Weaver, as this like really dumb, ditzy blonde that we never see Sigourney Weaver play. If you are a fan of science fiction movies, just and you haven't revisited Galaxy Quest in a long time, do so. I promise, even the CGI in that movie is not as bad as you would expect it to be all these years later.
Yeah, that's a pretty underrated one. I mean, that's kind of like a little bit of a cult classic. It's crazy to me that Sam Rockwell was in that. I feel like Sam Rockwell's been the same age my entire life. He was born in 68. Like, he was 31 in that movie. I feel like he was 31 when he did Billboards. So it always confuses me. I never know how old he is. All right. So I watched two really good ones. And the one I just watched before we hopped on here was To Joy, Ingmar Bergman's movie. It gets kind of a bad rap, but I think that's also because the expectations with a Bergman movie are so high. I loved it. I only gave it 3.5. I think it's probably going to move up. It's such a good movie. It's so relatable. It's just about a couple going through the rigors of like trying to form the relationship while they're both musicians in an orchestra. And so like, it's about like their dreams getting in the way of their life. It is so well done and it's so simple. And I just love Bergman, so that helps. But I also finished the Harry Potter rewatch, and I will say that the fifth one is by and away the best one. It's not even close. I don't care what anybody says. The eighth one is very okay. The seventh one stinks. But yeah, that one's the best. But I am going back to classic Hollywood, 1942, To Be or Not to Be. What a funny freaking movie that movie was. It's Ernst Lubitsch. The movie is downright hilarious, and it is 80 years old. That doesn't happen often. A lot of times when you go back and watch these old school comedies, a lot of it is just like, oh, that's funny. Like at the time, I don't really get that joke, whatever. There is not one moment in this movie where I was like, I don't understand what they're referencing. I don't get it because I'm too young. Oh my God. It is just about a troupe of actors in Poland who are trying to stay hidden from the Nazis by pretending to be Nazis. Movie is hilarious. It is downright hilarious. It's got Jack Benny in it. He's great. Carol Lombard's in it. It's just, it just keeps going. And every time that you think like, okay, it's finally found its way and it's stopped, like it's not going to be as funny anymore. It just keeps going. It just keeps going. And the number one review on Letterboxd, which I'm just seeing right now, which makes me so happy because it's like the best part ever. But it won't even ruin anything because once you watch the movie, you're going to die anyway. But the line is just, so they call me Concentration Camp Earhart. And it's so like, once you watch the movie and you're in on that joke, just reading that line makes me laugh because it's such a ridiculous premise. Great movie. Holds up 80 years later, worth a watch. It's on HBO Max here in the States. I don't know what it's on up there in Canada, but people should check that one out. It's downright hilarious.
I'll have to give that one a watch.
You will. You will. All right, John, tell us all about this movie that nobody's ever heard of.
So, I mentioned it before. James Bond is so pivotal to my movie-going experience. The first movie I ever saw in theaters was GoldenEye at the ripe old age of, what,
7?
4?
Oh, 4. That's right. That one came out earlier than that. Yeah.
That came out in like 90. Yeah, it was 95. So 3 going on 4 at that point as a late baby. But ever since then, GoldenEye was just so important because it was kind of that, it was that language that really bridged myself and my father and my grandfather, was just movies. And it was because of these experiences of going to James Bond, going to a James Bond movie every time it's released with my dad and seeing it. And as I grew older, I became very aware that the James Bond movies that were coming out as I was growing up were really bad. But I then revisited the older James Bond movies. And when it comes to Goldfinger, like you said, Phil, this is the quintessential James Bond film. There's no way around it. Dr. No doesn't quite feel Bondy enough. It's still a great movie, but it feels like it's missing something when it comes to James Bond. From Russia with Love is the one that a lot of people claim is the best Sean Connery movie. But to me, I just think Goldfinger isn't even my favorite James Bond movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's my second favorite. We'll talk about my favorite in a couple of weeks. But I think Goldfinger's the best James Bond movie. And a lot of it comes down to it just captures the essence of what James Bond really is. Everything from the opening, where we see James Bond in his wetsuit setting the explosives, and then he takes it off and he's wearing the white tux.
Yeah.
Like there's no scene that sums up James Bond more than that, because it's just, that's how suave of a man he is. And then we continue on and we get him looking in the reflections of the woman, of the eyes of the woman he's kissing, to see his assailant coming, and just how quickly he turns it. It has a killer Shirley Bassey theme that just, it's unparalleled how good this theme is if we're not comparing it to another Shirley Bassey theme song. And it has Orrick Goldfinger, who, mm-hmm. aside from Ernest Blofeld, who was in multiple James Bond movies, has to be the best James Bond villain of all time.
I think Blofeld still does not match up to Goldfinger, because Blofeld is so many different versions of Blofeld.
Mm-hmm.
Orrick Goldfinger is like iconic. Like, it is ridiculous how iconic. Or, and Oddjob too. I mean, Oddjob, who speaks, I think, one line in the entire movie, says one word, I think. He is like, those are just such iconic villains. See, so now I'm gonna get on my my soapbox here, and I'm gonna start going, because I have some hot takes when it comes to James Bond. But I will agree with you. From Dr. No doesn't do it for me. From Russia with Love, which I like more than Goldfinger, is still not quite Bond yet. It's getting there, but it's not. Like, Robert Shaw is too real of a villain in that movie. Goldfinger is when it starts to become the fun and games. And I think, and you know, you're probably going to disagree with me on this, but this is my podcast, so I'll say it. I think that people got so angry with the Pierce Brosnan ones, and then were so happy when Casino Royale came out, that it went serious, dark, boom, like, this is what we're going to do. That's why a movie like Spectre doesn't get the love that it deserves, when I actually believe that Spectre is the most authentic James Bond movie of the Daniel Craig movies, because it does all this stuff. See, like, the whole chase scene at the beginning, and then he falls and he lands on the couch, and everybody's like, oh, he landed on the couch. Yeah, he did land on the couch. He saw, in the one that is the quintessential Bond, he saw his killer coming in the eyes of a woman he was making out with. Like, I don't want to hear it. I don't want to hear it. And I think people lost the fun during the Pierce Brosnan ones, because they went so far with it that they don't want them to just be fun anymore. They want them to be these dark, brooding movies. And I actually think No Time to Die, spoilers. Okay, you had time to turn it off. Come back in 25 seconds. Despite how it ends, is actually one of the more fun of the Daniel Craig movies, because the Daniel Craig ones are just really dark. Goldfinger does such a good job of balancing the over-the-top ridiculousness. We have the freaking femme fatale in this movie, or whatever you want to call it, is named Pussy Galore.
Yes.
Pussy Galore. That is her name. This movie was rated PG in 1964 with a character named Pussy Galore. I'm just saying that. I like that blows my mind. Like all of that odd job with the hat that sometimes breaks statues' heads and then other times just knocks people down, whatever. It doesn't matter. It's just fun. It's gadgets. It's villains that have ridiculous plans. It's James Bond escaping situations for no apparent reason. Fun from start to finish. Love Goldfinger. Currently have it as my number four of all the James Bonds, which John and I, I actually just ranked mine today because my friend found my list from like 3 years ago. But we have our 25. We have them all ranked. John actually is 26. I don't have Never Say Never.
I do. I do have our unofficial Connery Bond in there. But yeah, that you're exactly right, Phil. And what Goldfinger does that its predecessors didn't do is it did have, it has so many of these iconic things that we associate with James Bond. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people misremember and think that From Russia with Love is where a lot of these things originated, but it's really Goldfinger. Things like this is the first James Bond movie to feature an Aston Martin.
Mm-hmm.
And like, it's not even just a subtle introduction of the Aston Martin. It's the, where's my Bentley? No, you have an Aston Martin now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Sorry, we don't have those now. Yeah.
And it's this, again, like we're going to keep using this word quintessential because it is just this quintessential spy car. It has everything that you associate with James Bond. It has the rims that extend out to be the blades. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It has, you know, the machine guns in the front of it. It has the ejector seat. This is everything we associate with a spy car. Mm-hmm. And then we have Oddjob, who, for people our age, Phil, sends trauma into because we all remember having to say no Oddjob every time we booted up GoldenEye.
Every single time you had to say no Oddjob and no Golden Gun.
Yeah.
Yep.
And it's so iconic. And he's not, despite the fact that he's this essentially a silent character who says one word a couple of times in the film, he isn't quite like the Asian stereotype we get in later James Bond movies when it comes to like a character like Riff Raff in Man with the Golden Gun.
Mm-hmm.
But he's still just so iconic. And granted, part of his iconicness does come from the fact that people in our generation do associate him with the GoldenEye video game. Mm-hmm. But even watching this film, the scene where he takes the statue's head off, it's iconic. It is something you associate with it. And so many things have like these parodies. Like if we look at like the Austin Powers movies of the 90s, almost everything they parody is from Goldfinger.
It was Goldmember. Like Goldmember
was literally one of the movies. Yeah. And you also have Auric Goldfinger's plan, which it sounds ridiculous when you explain it as he's going to explode a dirty bomb in Fort Knox to contaminate all of the U.S. gold supply to make himself richer. It sounds ridiculous, but it's so genius.
It's so fun too. Like, I will say that out of all of the Bond villain plots, this is my favorite one because it is so easy to understand. Sometimes, like in No Time to Die, by the way, I have No Time to Die as number three, and it might very well end up being my favorite one ever. I loved it. I thought it was like literally just phenomenal from start to finish. But what the hell is, you know, you have to really think about what Rami Malek's, you know, process is.
Microbots here. And things are.
Yeah, yeah, microbots and all that fun stuff. It gets kind of crazy. The 90s ones are all over the place, you know, with their random ass shit. But this one, it's so easy. He wants to make money. He wants more gold. He's obsessed with gold to the point where he named himself Goldfinger. He's obsessed with gold and he wants more gold. I get it. And now let's watch him go try to make this happen and let's watch the plot unfold. I'm all about it. All about all of it. It is such a fun plot and it's so fun to watch this one, you know, be thrown on its head and be thwarted as they're going into Fort Knox. Because first you're like, wait, he's pulling this off. How is James Bond going to stop him by himself? One of my favorite scenes is when Auric Goldfinger kills his own man right when he's switching sides and then runs around. They all go running in. He turns around and just shoots them all down. It's so ridiculous, but it's so much fun. And that's what Bond really is all about. That's what Bond really is all about. And Goldfinger knew what Bond was supposed to be all about.
Yeah. I mean, Guy Hamilton definitely figured it out at this point. He knew exactly what he was trying to do. And he just found this balance between the goofy things. You have to find the goofy things. Your femme fatale is called Pussy Galore. It's probably one of the funniest things you could possibly have for that type of character.
Yes.
And the fact that it came from a James Bond movie and not a parody of a James Bond movie is even more wild.
Is even fun. Because then when Austin Powers does a lot of vagina, it's actually not as ridiculous as Pussy. Pussy Galore is still more ridiculous than a lot of vagina.
Yeah. And so we still get that. We get these humor things. We get these beats of like James Bond making out with a girl and just being like, nope, you're taking the hit here.
Yep.
And like we have these ridiculous, we have the ridiculousness of Jill dying from skin suffocation because she was painted gold.
And they took the time to do that while she was just, you know, unconscious or something.
Like, that sentence is absolutely ridiculous. But it works so well in this because of the balance we have between those serious moments and the goofy ones. We even have, like, one of the weakest sequences in the film, I think, is the golf game.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly because James Bond's caddy's literally the worst.
Yeah, he's obnoxious. I agree with that.
It's incredible that Goldfinger didn't figure out what's going on because of how ridiculously this caddy overreacts to absolutely everything James is doing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still a fun sequence, despite the fact that it's weaker than the rest of the film.
Yes. Yes, and I think that's what needs to be noted is like it's still fun and it's still something we don't see in movies. The whole thing of like how he screws over Goldfinger, and Goldfinger does, you know, admit later that, you know, he knows he got screwed. Like he knows it. He just doesn't know how James pulled it off. Like those are those little fun things of I think what this one benefits from a lot more than the others are how many interactions there are with Goldfinger and James Bond together.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't see that a lot. I mean, every now and then you'll get where James Bond is, you know, messing with the character or whatever, but Casino Royale has it a lot. This one probably has it the most though. I think that's what helps elevate Goldfinger as a villain. It's what helps elevate this movie as a whole because we get to see them interact so much, and that's where your fun and games comes in. Goldfinger is a lot of fun and games that takes itself pretty seriously. That's a hard thing to pull off. And you know, I'd rather see him go and play a golf game that I have to kind of overthink a little bit what's going on here than, you know, just have a random conversation with somebody that I am not going to see again later on in the movie. Like it's not, and we see that a lot, especially in the Roger Moore ones It's like, we don't want to show you the villain. So instead we're going to show you some random character that's going to do something quirky and then explode.
Yeah. And what we get because of that is we get classic lines like, no, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die.
The best.
Which is probably one of the, aside from Bond, James Bond, and Shaken, Not Stirred, probably the most iconic James Bond line of all time.
Mm-hmm. And his delivery of that line is unbelievable. His delivery of that line and his little laugh is fantastic.
Yeah. And then we still get to see how good James Bond is at his job at that point, too. Because we get him talking his way out of literally getting killed right then and there.
Mm-hmm.
There's no reason Goldfinger should take him off that table.
No.
But James Bond is still able. He's not wrangling his way out of it at all. He's not, like, twisting out of the restraints at all. He talks his way by appealing to Goldfinger's ego so that he doesn't die. And that just feels so much more than what everything we've seen James Bond do up to that point.
Yeah, and having a villain that we understand so well makes that easier too. And I'm all about keeping the villain a mystery and all that, but to understand Goldfinger and how egotistical he is and really grasp it, he's not on some private island. You know what? Like he's he's very much like he wants people to see his stuff. He calls in all the villains so that he can kill them all. You know, like he's right in the heart of things. I think that, you know, that his escape there, he doesn't really escape. He just says, hey, you know, 008 will end up knowing all this. It feels authentic and it feels like a legitimate get out. And it's better that he's able to convince Goldfinger to let him out rather than some ridiculous escape where he cuts some, like it feels more authentic, which makes it feel like this is a serious movie, even though at the end of the day, it's still a Bond movie.
And I mean, we're talking about like the gadgets and everything. And aside from the Aston Martin is the biggest gadget in this entire film, because the only other gadget he has are his tracking devices, which are then used to show the incompetence of Americans.
Yes.
Imagine a British film doing that. I would never imagine that such a thing.
John, I feel like you're trying to take digs here. So
no, I'm just saying what the film says.
Mm-hmm.
I can only say what was presented in the film, but it still has like those through lines of James Bond where, yes, we get Q. And Q is by far my favorite James Bond character.
Desmond Llewellyn plays it the best by far,
too. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
He steals the show in every single movie he's in. And having Q Branch there is so important. It's kind of what made Casino Royale and Quantum of Solace, when they came out, not as good. The absence of Q Branch just didn't feel like James Bond.
Mm-hmm.
But Goldfinger is really where Q Branch starts shining in what they really do for Bond. And we also have like the quippiness of Bond in this film a lot more. The opening sequence where the assailant's coming at him and he pushes him in the tub and kills him with the space heater.
With the space heater. Love it.
And goes, shocking.
And positively then literally looks shocking. Looks at the girl who's dying on the ground and says, absolutely shocking. Yeah.
It's so James Bond. And this is like where this iconic, everlasting franchise is really born.
Because you think about it, in the first one that Sean Connery's not in, on Her Majesty's Secret Service, after the whole chase scene at the beginning, he literally looks at the camera, George Lazenby looks at the camera and says, it was so much easier for the other guy or something like that.
Yeah.
But that, it fits in, like, that is considered one of the best Bond movies, and it has a line like that that would normally make you roll your eyes. But this movie established that it was okay to break that fourth wall and laugh, and you could laugh with them rather than like have to feel like the joke's happening around you.
It's just the magic of James Bond, and it's why this film franchise has turned out 25 official films plus 3 unofficial films over 50 years.
Mm-hmm. 60.
Yeah, I guess we are getting on.
Dr. No came out in 1962, and it's 2021. So on January 1st, 60-year-old franchise.
Yeah. And they still pump them out because they still make money, because people still enjoy going to these films. And it's – you can never convince me it's not because of what Goldfinger establishes the franchise as.
I agree. No, I agree. And I think if you were to ask like a dad, which, you know, the Bond movies are such a dad franchise. If you were to ask a dad, what's your favorite Bond? Most of them are probably going to say Goldfinger. And I'm thinking like the people like John and I have our lists, and I think we should read out our top 10s just because that's fun. But we have our lists. I'm talking about people who don't even have a list. It's just if you were to ask them, what's your favorite Bond? The first one that's going to come to mind is Goldfinger. It's Goldfinger. Every time. Like it's just, this is that, it's that movie. And thank, like, you know, I think nowadays too, we see it all the time with, like, you know, we have Judy Dench's speech in, is it GoldenEye or whatever one it is, where it's like, you're a relic, you're a dinosaur, whatever that whole speech is about, like, you know, you're a chauvinistic pig and all that. James Bond is like a chauvinist and all these things. But I also think that not every hero in every movie has to be a perfect person. And I think what's being missed nowadays is when you try to create a hero in a movie, they normally try to make them so perfect because they're worried that something like this, like him, you know, sleeping with everybody in the movie, isn't going to be received positively. And critics might not receive it positively because critics are, you know, going that route.
Yeah.
But the general population, if you make a character as entertaining as James Bond, they're not really going to care what they do because they're just going to be like, oh, James. That's why you can still make this movie 60 years later. And they try to change up what Daniel Craig gets away with and all that. He can get away with anything because it's James Bond and it's been established and people have already acknowledged that they love it. So all the people who want to be like, we need to change James Bond, you're not going to do it. And if you do, the movie's not going to make very much money because people are going to be annoyed that it's not James Bond.
And that's the thing is, like, we can acknowledge the faults of this movie. The scene where James seduces Pussy and they tumble in the hay, not okay. Great not scene. Okay, because he's just, it's a great scene. Bond's forcing himself on her. Not okay from a moral standpoint. But when we watch it, we can acknowledge that and still look at the movie around it at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and also it's, I mean, first of all, it's the 60s. So it's, you know, the whole, but it's supposed to be like James Bond, literally, like, that's just the kind of character he's always going to find a way to do everything in the movie.
At least they didn't just straight up say Pussy Galore was a lesbian like she is in the book.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, if they at least toned that part down a bit.
John.
They at least toned that part apart where at least James Bond isn't changing people's sexuality. So,
oh, yeah, she's got her whole flying circus, man. She's fine.
She does.
The flying circus is also just top notch. Love it.
It is. It is. And even when we're looking at the way the film's structured, from a storytelling standpoint, like the foreshadowing of James telling Pussy not to fire the gun in the cabin of the plane to then like be the end of the film. It's just great storytelling. It's great understanding of story structure. And of course, Ian Fleming gets credited with this as well for writing the original story, but the transition from novel to book or to screen, James Bond's just always been killing it.
Yeah, absolutely. John, why don't you go with what's your worst James Bond movie, and then what's your top 10 from 10 to 1? I want to hear it.
Okay, so my worst James Bond movie is Die Another Day. It was the last film in the Pierce Brosnan era, and oh, that movie's bad.
Hot take there, man. Everybody loves that one.
On my recent rewatch, ooh, that was a struggle to get through. But if we're going through my top 10, so number one, we are going to talk about it in a few weeks.
Start with 10, man. You got to start with 10.
You said 1 to 10.
10 to 1. So we're counting down, not up.
Okay. So 10's No Time to Die. And I have it lower on my list because I didn't really appreciate the ending on a first watch. Now, understanding how the Daniel Craig movies are kind of framed in the James Bond universe, on a rewatch, it will probably increase because it did have one of the best sequences in a James Bond movie with the staircase scene. And like you said, it's a completely engaging movie from start to finish. Above that right now, I have Casino Royale. It was a fresh take on Bond. I'm not as high on it as a lot of other people are on it because it doesn't have the fun of James Bond like we've talked about. But still good. Daniel Craig's great in it. David Green's great in it. Anything with Mads Mikkelsen's usually good.
Yeah.
So it's a good one. I then have Spectre because I do think it does capture the fun of James Bond. And it's the most Bond-feeling film of the Daniel Craig era.
I should have looked up what your list was because I was assuming you were going to be on the downtrain on Spectre. We have it in the exact same spot.
No, I love Spectre. I actually, on the first watch, I hated it. But when you watch Bond sequentially, you really see what Spectre's trying to do.
Absolutely. It's got to get away from the darkness of Skyfall.
Yeah. And then I have Honor, Majesty, Secret Servants. George Lazenby will forever be the most underrated James Bond, but is getting a lot more accolades recently. And the inclusion of the importance of that film into No Time to Die, really important. I then have The Spy Who Loved Me. Which
is
I think
number is, 6. You have that at 6?
Yes.
Okay.
I think it's Moore's best film by a lot. It's not as more. The Moore era really turned, like we talked about, like this balance between the Goofy and the serious in Goldfinger, the Moore era really leaned way too much into this extravagant goofiness, and it wasn't good, but The Spy Who Loved Me is phenomenal. I have Never Say Never Again as number five, which is the unofficial James Bond movie directed by Irvin Kirshner.
Now, if you didn't have Never Say Never, what's your number 11 on that list that would have moved into the top 10 if you didn't
have
Never Say
Never? It is GoldenEye.
Okay, so GoldenEye would have been your 10 if you didn't count the unofficial one. Okay,
yeah.
Continue.
But Never Say Never Again, it gives us this aging Bond, which is kind of like was what Skyfall did, but Never Say Never Again did it way better. It brought Connery back to the franchise, and it's Thunderball. But better told than Thunderball was. Number four is The Living Daylights. Timothy Dalton, incredibly underrated as James Bond. His movies were so far ahead of their time because they did give us... The Timothy Dalton era, the two films, are essentially the Daniel Craig era. But people weren't ready for it yet.
And they were perfect. They needed to, because after the disaster that was the Moore era, we needed something that was a little bit darker. But again, how do we keep the fun and games in it? You know?
Then I have From Russia with Love, when we already talked about it today. It's a classic. It's a very good film. It's just not quite a good Bond film. Then Goldfinger at number two, and I finish it off with You Only Live Twice, and I will not discuss that one until we actually get to it.
Okay, so you have You Only Live Twice at number one. Okay, I forgot that was the other one on your list. I couldn't remember what the other one on this list was. So I have A View to a Kill as the worst one. That movie is bad in my estimation. What a
but
waste
a great Duran Duran track.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know, man. It just I couldn't stand it. Grace Jones, I did actually see live perform like a set for some reason when I was at a music festival in California. But I really hate A View to a Kill. I think that's that and Quantum of Solace are the only two Bond movies I actually dislike. Die Another Day, I think it's pretty much like watching Batman and Robin. It's like, why did they make this? I don't know. But I'm going to sit down and I'm going to say
it's the same era, right?
Yeah,
it's the same era. Thing. It's exactly what Hollywood was doing at that time. Hollywood just didn't understand what was happening in that time when it came to blockbusters.
Yeah. Fun fact, though, so we'll get there. But I want to just tell you that my second highest ranked Roger Moore movie is at number 16. Just so you can kind of put that in your head as I go through my list here. So my second highest ranked Roger Moore movie is number 16, and it's Live and Let Die. I have You Only Live Twice at number 10. I won't talk about it as to not spoil your fun later. At number 9, I have Skyfall. I think that's the most overrated Bond movie, but I still have it in my top 10. I think people totally blow out of proportion how good that one is. Amazing set design. The end of that movie is crazy. The whole bunker thing. I think it's very slow for a Bond movie, though. It definitely gets better on a rewatch, but I think it's just super, super overrated. Also, the Adele song is overrated. Number 8, I have Spectre, which I talked about. What were you going to say about Adele? Go ahead. I don't want to jump over you on that.
I wasn't going to say anything about Adele. I was going to say the problem with Skyfall is that the last part of the movie is actually Home Alone.
It is. Except Home Alone, which I just rewatched, it takes really long to get to being Home Alone, which is weird.
It does.
Very much does. Number 8, I have Spectre. Number 7, I have The Living Daylights. I think Timothy Dalton might be my second favorite Bond behind Sean Connery. And if Sean Connery wasn't an icon and I didn't get in trouble for saying it, Timothy Dalton might be my favorite Bond. But I don't want to get in trouble. Also, The Living Daylights has the best poster by far. Not even close. Oh, my God. What a poster. Number 6, Casino Royale, you know, just it was fun because they started to really build the story. Felt like a lot of the Bonds before that, they were loosely connected and whatever. But that one, it felt like, okay, we have a plan here with these Daniel Craig movies. We're gonna tell a story. And I really love the Eva Green stuff in that movie. Number 5, License to Kill. Like I said, I love Timothy Dalton. Think he's great. Love everything. 4, I have Goldfinger. 3, I have No Time to Die. I thought the pacing of No Time to Die was phenomenal. I thought that one, again, like I said, with Casino Royale, they started the story. They told the story. They forgot in Quantum of Solace that they were telling a story, and then they continued to tell it again. And then they just knocked it out of the park, in my estimation, with this Bond movie. My favorite movie of the year so far that I've seen. Number 2, I have From Russia with Love. Again, like you said, not really a Bond movie, but Robert Shaw's villain is phenomenal in that movie. From Russia with Love, just a really, 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 really good movie. And as I said, my number 16 is the second highest ranked Roger Moore. That's how bad I think the Roger Moores are. But my number one is The Spy Who Loved Me. I love The Spy Who Loved Me. And it was hard for me not to say it, but considering there's such a gap between the best Roger Moore and the next best Roger Moore, this one is just, I love the Carly Simon song, first of all, is my favorite of all the Bond songs. It's great, even though the Goldfinger one was stuck in my head and I was walking around my apartment screaming it the other day. But the Carly Simon song is the best. I love Jaws. I think that's fun. The whole, like him and who's the Bond girl in this one? Is it, I forget what her name is. Him and the Bond girl, it's like one of my favorite with the Bond girl. It went back to having fun. It just like it, but not in a, we have to be corny and be childish. They were just fun. It was just fun. And they cut out all the schlock, even though there's still schlock, but they cut out enough of the schlock. What'd you say?
It was Barbara Bach.
Okay. That's who it was, but they cut out enough of the schlock that, you know, we didn't need and like Live and Let Die and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And they managed to make just a great Bond movie with Roger Moore, who's probably the worst Bond. And they still made a great Bond movie, and it's my favorite one. I think it's great from start to finish. The opening of The Spy Who Loved Me is just like second to none. So that's what I have at number one, The Spy Who Loved Me.
And the moment where, spoiler alert for a movie that came out like 50 years ago.
Yeah, and it's James Bond. You should have seen it by now.
It's James Bond, so you probably should have seen it. The moment where she becomes aware that James killed her boyfriend is just, it's one of the most powerful James Bond moments of all time.
Yeah, their dynamic is just so much fun. It's just so much fun. And the villains, like, again, Jaws, such a stupid idea, but it works because it's James Bond. I love
it. It doesn't work in Moonraker.
Well, yeah, and then but at least he falls in love, right?
Yeah, of course.
And then what is it? This is the one with the pyramids, right? I'm not misremembering. Yes. This is like the pyramid. Oh, man, right. I love all that stuff.
It's so good. It's absolutely iconic, and it gets overlooked because it's a Roger Moore movie. Mm-hmm. But seriously, if you haven't revisited the Roger Moore era, you can skip most of them. Never skip.
No, never skip that one. Never skip that one. And I would honestly say, I really think Live and Let Die, The Man with the Golden Gun, they're not bad by any means. It's after that that I start to be like, what are we doing? Moonraker, For Your Eyes Only, you know, A View to a Kill, yikes. You know, I don't know. It is what it is.
Octopussy.
Oh, my God. Yeah. How did I skip Octopussy? What am I doing? God. Yeah. But I have A View to a Kill as the worst one, and then Moonraker and Octopussy just there. But anyway, that's where we're at. That's it. That's going to do it for tonight. So we're going to be back again next week as we move on to number 55 on our list, which for John is Fantasia. So that should be fun. Love me a good dialogue heavy movie. And for me is The Last Picture Show, which should be a lot of fun. Love me a nice, depressing black and white movie about a town in the middle of nowhere where everybody's just waiting to die. So Last Picture Show from 1971, Fantasia from 1940. The week after that, though, we're not going to continue counting down the top 100. We're going to do a little year-end 2021 list here. Not list so much, but favorite movie from 2021, top five movies we watched this year, even if they're not from 2021. I'm very close to hitting 365 movies in 365 days. I'm going to make sure that happens. And so I think it'd be fun for us to kind of just say, like, what were the hidden gems? You know, a couple. We have a bunch of different categories. That's what we're going to be doing the week in between Christmas and the new year. And then it's 2022. And John and I, none of you thought we were going to make it 12 months of this shit. None of you. Here we are. So we'll see you again next week. John, always a pleasure. And everybody else, go watch The Spy Who Loved Me, because it's worth it and it's fun and it's the week before Christmas, so you might as well.